Hello, Matt. How's your post-debate sleep?
Things are going pretty well. I thought this was the third debate, the second presidential, and I thought it was probably the least exciting. I don't know if I'm becoming inured to debates, having endured 20-plus primary debates and now this, or if it was actually...
You thought this was less exciting than the first debate?
Yeah, well, I think that what made the first debate exciting was the surprise, the shock factor that of how well Romney did and how bad Obama did. And so I think that shock factor was you know, notable. And the second debate was a lot of fun, of course, with Joey Biden. I thought that this third debate was boring, but others disagree. George Will apparently said it was the greatest debate in the history of debate. So I guess it's in the eye.
I don't dispute your point about the surprise element of the first, but just the actual watch, this pure entertainment value of the debate itself. You know, the first one was just there. You know, obviously one person was very low energy. It's a lot more wonky minutia. You know, this was a real scrap. I would just think of just on sheer entertainment, this would be more fun to watch.
Well, and some of it might have been just the newness, the freshness. I mean, that was the first debate, so obviously that factors in. And some of it, frankly, might be that although I try to be as fair and balanced as possible, the fact that Mitt Romney, I think, did not perform terrifically perhaps has skewed my judgment. Maybe it's a bit of a Rorschach test, as these things often are.
But isn't it all Candy Crowley's fault?
I don't think it's all her fault. That would be...
It is also the voters' fault, correct?
Well, look, I think that in politics, the question is more important than the answer. And I think that most of that questions have a built-in skew, and most of them favored Barack Obama. I think that in town hall debate formats, by their very nature, that they tend to benefit liberals, I think. So it's not surprising to me that... That the questioners ask things that would more likely favor a Democrat. I do think that Candy Crowley overstepped her role. First of all, I thought she should have honored the agreement in terms of how to conduct the debate. And then, you know, the part you're talking about, this controversy, stems from Romney's allegation that Obama didn't get around to calling the attacks in Benghazi terrorism until weeks later. And Crowley inserted herself to point out that, in fact, Obama did use that term during the Rose Garden address the next day. Interestingly, though, she later conceded on CNN that... Romney was right, quote, in the main. And so, so in a sense, what she's saying is that Obama was right by the letter of the law, but Romney was right in the spirit of the law. And that's a nuanced thing, but you wouldn't know it if you watched the debate and saw her interject herself into the discussion, essentially shut Romney down, and basically throw a lifeline to Obama. So a lot of people are upset about that today.
Well, let me make two points about that. You know, one defending Crowley and one criticizing. Actually, I mean, 2 points criticizing, if I may. I mean, number one, what she was trying to do in the moment, if you look at the transcript again, she was trying to ding both of them or puff up both of them. She was saying, hey, Obama's right about this. He did say act of terror the day after. But she said, Romney, you are correct. Of course, she said, you are correct about that in reference to that it took 2 weeks for them to clear up the notion of there being a riot outside. So she was trying to be even-handed about it. But Obama jumped in at the first point and got a crowd reaction from that. And I think a lot of people missed the second part of what she said. But that's not Crowley's fault.
Well, you know, it is her fault. Number one, I think you're absolutely correct. I think that that she intended to sort of say, he's right about this. He's right about that. But it is her fault because, number one, she broke, at least my understanding of it is, that she broke or decided not to honor the agreement that the campaigns had crafted that presumably the Commission on Presidential Debates had okayed. I wonder if they...
That's true from the get-go. Pardon? She broke it from start to finish.
She did. And I think, but you know what? I think there might be a reason. Now, everybody was critical of the campaigns trying to manage the, you know, avoid saying anything interesting. But maybe there's a reason why some of those things were stipulated. And frankly, look, I think it's like a sporting event. If we're talking about the referees, if we're talking about the umpire, they did something wrong. They should not. So the number one thing driving the debate and the discussion today, as evidenced by the fact that we are opening our show with it, is Candy Crowley. And so whether she intended to or not, she really helped Barack Obama. And I think that's probably a bad thing for a moderator to do, especially when she concedes that it was a very nuanced position, that maybe Obama was right technically, but Mitt Romney was right on the larger point. So I think that she...
Well, let me address that part of it. Because I mean, you know, yes, she is saying that, but she is wrong in saying that. We just have a report from the New York. I mean, this is the thing. Just to backtrack, we've talked about this on a couple of shows. But you know, the conservative, you know, conservative America's argument to date has been the Obama administration has been misleading because they have not, they blame the video and not blame terrorism. And the Crowley point there that you're getting at, that in the main point is, yes, he said act of terror in the Rose Garden speech the day after, but for the 2 weeks following that, he didn't repeat that. He avoided the word terrorism while they were talking about the video a lot. As I was suggesting on past shows, you know, there's still a lot of murky information out there, and it's possible these things are conflated. We got a New York Times piece just yesterday saying every Libyan on the ground in Benghazi is saying, yes, it was an attack from a splinter terrorism group in retaliation for the video,
let me concede that it's murky, and I mean, I could argue, look, if Obama thought it was terrorism, why did he go to Vegas the next day and hold a fundraiser? Why did he go on The View? Why did Susan Rice go on Fox News Sunday and say it was the video and that it wasn't terrorism? Well, we could get into all that, and it is murky, and it's messy, and it's muddy, but to me, that's not the point. The point is that Candy Crowley took something that is a sort of questionable, debatable thing based on a little bit of nuance, and yes, Obama did allow some caveats, and she injected herself into it and made it a very clear Obama win. And it's the top story that we're talking about today. There are a couple other things that came out of the debate.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say Crowley made it a win. The big thing that made it a win, it was actually before she makes that point. When Romney looks at Obama, here's Obama saying that I said it was an act of terror the day after. Romney looks at Obama with this incredulous look and saying, "You're telling me that your claim is that the day after you said this was an act of terror?" And he paused, this dramatic pause. Like, there's this look in Romney's eyes. He thinks he has
right.
him. He thinks he's got him dead to rights.
No,
Obama's like...
I think you're right. And, I mean, both these guys, I think, are trained lawyers. But I think maybe Obama was employing a little bit of his legal training there. And maybe a little bit of an entrapment. And I think you're right. Look, Mitt Romney, if that were me, I would have keyed off of Obama's response and been like, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I need to talk about, yes, but, you know, Susan Rice went out and, you know, and back off a little bit, maybe allow for a little bit of nuance. And instead, Romney, and maybe it's hubris, doubled down. And that, you're right, that certainly contributed to the moment.
I think it's possible that Romney actually did not know the facts and actually thought he had Obama cornered.
No, I think that's obvious. I think you're right. I think that's very clear. But I still think if Candy Crowley doesn't jump in there, then it goes to the fact checkers who make the point that technically speaking, Barack Obama was right. He did reference, you know, terrorism, but Mitt Romney might be right in the main. That's what Candy Crowley said when she had some time to think about it and sort of collect her thoughts and to express it without Obama sort of jumping in there. But she did irreparable damage to Mitt Romney. Irreparable is a better term. She dramatically altered what a lot of people billed as the most important debate of the election by injecting herself into it and breaking the rules. That's my point.
Well, just to get into that part of it, I mean, this was discussed.
I'm drinking a lot of water, and like Paul Ryan here. So, you know, there'll be Paul Ryan joints.
Just so we don't go back and forth on Libya forever, I think we both made our points there. But as far as the Crowley thing is concerned, you know, here's the deal. And Mark Halperin was the one sort of tracking this at his Time Magazine site. You know, there's a memorandum of understanding between the two campaigns and the Commission on Presidential Debates that outlines what the moderator's role is going to be, and it creates for the town hall one an extremely limited role for the moderator. It's almost just, I'm going to pass the mic around. You know, I'm not going to really make any significant comments, you know, after the questions are made. But Crowley is not a signatory to that. She never was. And Crowley was saying ahead of time, I'm not going to do that.
But presumably, somebody from the Commission on Presidential Debates presumably invited Crowley to be the moderator. And I suppose that when that happens, there has to be some sort of official paperwork and agreement that she is agreeing to abide by the rules. I mean, I'm sure they said it's going to be at Hofstra University. I mean, she could have just said, no, we're going to Denver. But no, she complied with, what time does it start? All those things. I mean, did they not brief her? I don't think we know the answer to that. But
well, I don't know exactly what happened internally there, but she made very clear publicly what her approach was going to be.
But no, look, she should have either accepted the rules, this signed document, which, by the way, is nothing new. This is exactly the same rules that governed the debate 4 years ago, the town hall debate. I mean, there's nothing.
And Tom Brokaw was even worse than Crowley in this regard.
Here's my
thing.
If she didn't want to play by the rules, we have a thing called the rule of law. I mean, if she didn't want to honor the agreement, she could have bowed out and allowed somebody. Look, I agree with you. I think the rules are silly. I think that they should be allowed to do more than just be, you know, Oprah Winfrey. But if you, if there are rules agreed upon, then the honorable thing to do is to comply with them or, you know, take yourself out. Bring in someone who will.
Well, I mean, Crowley chose a different path saying, I didn't sign this. I'm not going to abide by it. Here's what I'm going to do. Hey, Commission, if you want to fire me now, go. I mean, she didn't say it like this, of course, but the subject is, if you don't like the way I'm going to do this, you could boot me right now. They don't got to keep her around. They could say, you're not going to have this agreement? Fine, we'll get somebody else. Look, you know, they didn't do
that.
And the candidates knowing.
Commission on President.
So this is one point. The candidates heard what Crowley said. They didn't raise a public fuss about it. You got to steel yourself for the fact that things aren't going to go as scripted in an unrehearsed, you know, free-form debate. And the candidate that's whining about the rules is usually the candidate that's losing. Look, there were questions there, to shift to the other point about the questions themselves from the voters. I haven't counted up all the questions, but I can see it's possible that more of the questions were a little bit more loaded to Romney than loaded towards Obama. But there were a couple of questions that were loaded towards Obama. One was the Libya one, for example. That was from a guy, and I saw this on Twitter, that someone actually found that guy had liked the Michelle Malkin video on YouTube within 5 seconds of his question.
Well, that question also came about 70 minutes into the debate. I mean,
well, it's still the question that we're talking about mostly right now. And when that question was fired at Obama, there was no Romney elbow in that question at all. About took the question and dealt with it and turned it around to his behalf. Same thing with the gas price question, which was clearly a question that was trying to, smack Obama upside the head. He turned that question around too. If you're going to handle a debate setting, you got to handle a tough question. And the candidate that does that is usually the one that gets the dramatic moment. When you would knock at a softball, people don't care about that as much.
Here's what I would like to see happen. I think these town hall debates are basically reality shows. If you want to do a town hall, I'd like to see
whole campaign's a reality show.
Well, I'd like to see Romney do an hour by himself, taking questions from a town hall, citizenry of undecided voters, and then I'd like to see Obama do it. rather than the debate facade and the whole, you know, showmanship of it. But let me just close out my comment on Crowley, because I want to be clear on this. I agree with you that the moderator should have more leeway than the rules stipulate. But I think that, you know, it's incumbent upon us to adhere to the agreed upon rules. And she unilaterally decided not to do that. And in so doing, injected herself into the debate and became part of the story. In fact, perhaps the dominant part of the story. And it, I don't think, would have happened had she complied with the agreement. So, I mean, I think it was a horrible, performance by her. And, you know, I hope she doesn't do it again. And I think the debate on the presidential commission, whatever their name is, someone needs to take a really close look at this group. I mean, did they not clear it with the moderator? Does the moderator not agree to honor the conditions that the commission and the campaigns agreed to? I mean, whether they're silly or not,
well, the commission's not going to go back and review their process if they think most people were unhappy about the outcome. If the only people complaining about it are diehard Romney supporters, the commission's not necessarily going to be upset about that.
Why do any sort of agreement? If the moderator can just show up and unilaterally decide, why have any sort of agreement? I mean, the campaigns can't complain, because you're right. If you're complaining, I mean, that's why I'm complaining. But the campaigns can't really, I mean, you know, remember Paul Ryan was asked about Raddatz before, Martha Raddatz, and he had to say, oh, she's great, she'll be fine, I've got no worries. Of course he can't complain about a biased moderator. He would look bad. I mean, that's why we have,
we would talk about this a lot, but, you know, Raddatz at one point fact-checked Biden, if I recall, it was about Afghanistan, and I thought that was not, I mean, and I'll say this about Crowley too. If you're going to play fact checker, do it consistently. If you're very selective about your fact checking and you just pick one moment to fact check where there's all sorts of, you know, mistruths flying around, you're now implicitly validating the other mistruths because you're only calling out, you know, every so often. I think there are, if you're not going to do it consistently, you are giving your imprimatur to all the other misstatements that were made. I think Raddatz made that mistake. I think Crowley made that mistake.
I think
Lehrer avoids that mistake by being a potted plant the entire time.
Well, I think I'm of the opinion that the candidates go at it and stay out of the way. I mean, I think you're of a different.
Well, that was the Lehrer model.
Yeah, you're of a different.
It is an interesting dynamic because, you know, after that debate, you had, maybe it was at the Raddatz, right? Or maybe it was just bringing both together, but it was the RNC, the head of the Commission of the Debates is a former RNC chair, and I guess now it's Mike McCurry. It used to be a former DNC chair, but now it's Mike McCurry, his former Clinton press secretary. The other guy said, you know, in my experience, the people who complain about the moderator are the people that lost. Suggesting I'm not going to be swayed by a one-way critique about the moderator, and I'm saying that to the left about Jim Lehrer, and I'm saying that about the right about, you know, Martha Raddatz's ex-husband being at the, you know,
but Bill, that's,
Obama being
that
at the wedding.
Look, if the Orioles play the Yankees and the ref makes a bad call that hurts the Orioles, of course the Orioles are going to be the side that complains, and of course the Yankees are going to say it's fine, but that doesn't mean that Major League Baseball shouldn't review the play, and it doesn't mean that we should.
A ball that is not a home run that becomes a home run is a much more concrete thing than doing a fact check, which is actually an actual fact check, which is not an accurate statement made by the moderator. You could say she was loose with the agreement that was made, but, you know, that's pretty technical stuff. You as the presidential candidate, it's like a playoff team. A good playoff team can handle a bad call. A good playoff team, it doesn't play it so close that they get hung up by
right,
that.
But,
you're a World
but
Series champion team. You've got seven games to play. One bad call doesn't knock you out.
If we're Wilbon and Tony Kornheiser, this is our job to complain. I mean, the candidates and the campaigns, I mean, this is precisely what we ought to do. So I think I'm like, well within my rights to be complaining about it. I'm the kind of person that ought to do it, and I really hope that this commission gets their act together, because why – who – you know more about this than I do, Bill. I mean, it's not like they've always done the debates. This is a fairly modern phenomenon. Who died and made them in charge of debates?
Well, if I can get like super geeky for a second, I've been reading about this a little bit more, and I'm not, you know, the expert. I know there's others who know more than I do. But, you know, so we've only really been doing this since 76, and the commission has only been doing it since 92, before there was legal women voters. And, you know, and there actually were a lot of problems that the frustrations happened when the League of Women Voters was doing it. So you look at the 80 debate, Carter Reagan, the questions are very genteel. You look at the 84 debates. There actually was a scuffle there before the first debate because, you know, we talked about how a panel could actually be constructed in the modern era. This actually was an issue in 84. They gave a list of journalists to both campaigns of 80-plus journalists, said, okay, you two have to agree which ones we pick so no one can charge bias. And Mondale and Reagan couldn't agree on anybody. And it got so bad that the League of Women Voters actually held a press conference before the first debate attacking both campaigns for being a bunch of children about the whole thing. And they only could – and they're going to have four panelists. They only could agree on three. And Barbara Walters, to kick off the debate, attacked them both at the debate itself for the fact that they couldn't have a fourth journalist be there. And I don't know if this is the case, but the questioning for that first debate was much more pointed and much more loaded towards both campaigns than the 1981 was. And I think it's because they were both so angry at the campaigns for the way they handled that whole journalism. They didn't want to be accused of being mealy-mouthed and handpicked by the campaigns. They want to show their toughness. You know, Fred Barnes, of all people, asked Reagan this nasty religious question at that debate. And then, of course, 88, we had the George Bernard Shaw, you know, Dukakis rape question, which is a really nasty question. It's after that that the commission comes in and says, okay, forget the whole panel. Let's have single moderators, and they'll be more defanged. But they've also had, since then, the town halls. And, you know, I didn't remember this, but I was listening to Rush Limbaugh just the other day. He was complaining about Ponytail Guy. I mean, you might remember this, or do you remember this whole thing, Ponytail Guy?
No, but I did hear Rush mention that, and but I didn't remember the reference.
So it's the first town hall debate, and I believe that town hall was not strictly undecided voters the way they've been doing it lately, but it was meant to be a cross-section of America of all stripes. And so there's this guy, he's got a ponytail and a mustache, and he asks... he gives a whole soliloquy about government meeting our needs, and you know which of you are going to meet our needs. And it's a very liberal sounding question, and this is the question where Bush looked down at his watch. This is the way Rush retold it. I haven't gone back and looked at the tape myself, but that's the question that Clinton really knocked out of the park. So Rush is here blaming Ponytail Guy, and I want to give this guy's actual name because I think it's unfair just to dismiss him because he has a ponytail. But you know, this is the same argument that you were making before. It was unfair that this guy got to ask a question.
Yeah, look, I think and, questions in politics, questions matter more than answers, and the moderators, there are questions that they couldn't ask because it would be obvious that it's biased, liberal bias. They'd be ashamed or just, you know, they couldn't do it. So they can use these quote-unquote undecided voters as surrogates to do their dirty work. And I really seriously question, there wasn't applause when Candy Crowley fact-checked Romney, and I hate to keep going back to it. But, you know, there was applause, and apparently Michelle Obama was one of the one of them applauding, which would be a violation of the rules. But she wasn't the only one. I mean, were these undecided voters who suddenly decided that they knew that they remembered what Obama said, you know, a month ago at the Rose Garden and were applauding him because they're undecided? Or are they big Candy Crowley fans?
Well, I think there are the people in the room. There are other people.
Maybe
watching,
maybe
right?
They were maybe not they just were for the... Obama, but in that case they broke the rules. I mean, again, not that of course you know that nobody cares about the rules. I mean, it's pedantic of me to bring that up, and clearly a sign of losing if you dare cite, you know, actually the rules.
Well, so let me finish the 1992 thing. So it's Denton Walthall. So I'll give us, I want to give this guy his place in history, Denton Walthall. And he said in his question, he said, the focus of my work as a domestic mediator is meeting the needs of the children that I work with by way of their parents, not the wants of their parents. I asked the three of you, how can we, as symbolically the children of the future present, expect the two of you, the three of you, to meet our needs, the needs in housing and in crime, and you name it? Can we cross our hearts? It sounds silly here, but can we make a commitment? It's a real need, I think, that we all have. So here, it takes a village kind of question. And so the conservatives remember this moment, Rush remembers this moment, and implies that this guy doesn't have a right to ask a question at debate. This is the question where a conservative could have certainly asked a conservative question. I'm sure they probably did, but I haven't gone back and looked at the transcript yet myself. But because of the criticism of that, they've shifted now to let's have only undecided voters. So we'll try to take off this notion that people can ask a real ideologically pointed question. But of course, as we've seen, you know, an undecided voter is not necessarily middle of the road. You can have an undecided conservative voter, an undecided liberal voter. I think it's bizarre to presume that the 7% slice of America is indicative of the entire country, and they should be given undue power, these sorts of things. I'd rather see it be a full
process. And why do it in New York?
Country.
I mean, this is a nonpartisan criticism here. But if you're going to do undecided voters, why, if that's your sort of premise, why wouldn't you do them in Ohio or Florida or North Carolina or?
Well, I don't know why I wouldn't fly people in. I disagree with their decision to have only Nassau County undecideds. That strikes me.
What is the deal with that? I mean, that's ridiculous, utterly ridiculous.
I don't know. I was trying to find this morning, and I haven't been able to dig it up yet. I don't remember if it's always been the way. I thought they flew people in. I thought they'd be from all across the country.
They should have held it in Ohio. They should have done it in Ohio. Everybody knows that Ohio, if there's any state that has potential to be the most important state, it's Ohio. And why not do it there? Just, who knows? I mean, I guess these things are decided years in advance.
There's no one geographic area that speaks for the whole country.
True, but I mean, certainly New York is, I mean, the most representative.
Is it where Bill O'Reilly lives? Is it Hempstead near where Bill O'Reilly lives? It's not even necessarily that liberal part of the
no,
New
I'm
York.
No, I'm not saying it is. Hempstead. I'm just... Look, number one, I think it's – well, anyway, I've had my say about that. Let me bring up something else, Bill, that happened last night that I don't think has gotten much attention that I found interesting,
sure.
And that was Romney distancing himself from George W. Bush. Now, it was in response to a pointed question, but I still think it's worth noting.
You thought he did a good job distancing himself from Bush?
No, I thought it was notable that he started to distance himself from Bush and criticizing his not being tough enough on China, criticizing his budget deficits. I thought that Romney a long time ago should have triangulated and essentially run against his two predecessors of these two failed presidencies. I mean, this is what I would be telling Romney if I were advising him. But he never did that, and so I think that it's interesting that finally, even though he was pressed on it, he did, by name, and somewhat pointedly criticized George W. Bush in the debate. Now, nobody's talking about it today, but I thought it's sort of the untold story.
Well, we should talk about it, because I think this actually is a bigger deal. I think this is really much more fundamental about this race than the one Libya moment. And this gets back to, you know, my earlier case, which I've been mocked repeatedly over the last 2 weeks.
Our viewers are getting more into coming at us on Twitter now. It's not just the comments anymore. Now,
that's true.
They're hitting
true.
Us where we live.
You know, my point initially, it's not that debates are utterly meaningless. They don't have any impact on the polls whatsoever. My point was that in history, incumbents usually lose the first debate, and it's never led to a lead change. And the underlying part of that is that the fundamentals of the race don't change just because of one bad night. And there's mixed poll data out there, whether that's accurate or not right now. You can look at the Gallup tracking, which, you know, didn't actually collapse for Obama right away, but over the course of the 2 weeks, gradually – gave Romney a 4-point bump going into this debate, but the Washington Post poll went the other way. Obama gained 2 points among registered voters, gained 1 point among likely voters from a pre-debate poll to a post-debate poll. So that's sort of a murky assessment there. But I do think that what is most underlying here is, you know, does the country think that we're better off than we were 4 years ago? Obama's making the case that we are. Romney's saying that we're not. And I think part of the Romney case has to be, if we're not better off, what are you going to do differently than the guy that put us in the ditch in the right. first place? I think the conservative movement, the Republican Party, has not done a good job, not really tried, to say, okay, part of our program did not work from 00 to 08. We know it didn't work. We've learned our lesson, and we got something different now to deal with the country as it is. There hasn't been that soul-searching moment, that the lesson learning that they share with the public. So Romney comes in, asks the question point blank, and I think he gives a couple of really ticky-tack things that don't really suggest. No one thinks that we got in the Great Recession because Bush wasn't tough enough on China. There is a China issue there, but that wasn't the cause of the Great Collapse. So he really wasn't owning up to what he would do dramatically differently. And I think Obama nailed him on that point, that the centerpiece of what Romney's talking about is the same thing that Bush was talking about. And that, to me, if Romney can't answer that, I don't see how you get out of the state of the race where it was in early October. Now, we'll see, of course, if the polls do bounce back to where they were across the board after this debate, and whether my thesis is unquestionably holding up, but that's what I think is going to happen.
Well, I mean, I think a couple things. I mean, one, I think you're right. China is not what caused the collapse. Clearly, I've written before about what I think caused it, and there are basically Bush and Clinton era things: Fed keeping interest rates too low for too long, expanded mandate of Fannie and Freddie, mark-to-market accounting, repeal of the uptick rule, repeal of Glass-Steagall. I mean, these are all things that happened that were very. It's funny, you know, we talk about how the Bush and Obama foreign policy are surprisingly consistent and seamless. The Clinton-Bush policies toward economic policies were surprisingly similar in many ways, and led to a lot of problems, and I think led to the collapse. But still, it is interesting to see Romney again. I thought that a good strategy might be to sort of triangulate to run against Bush. Because, look, let's be honest, Obama spent the last couple years running against Bush and demonizing Bush. And so if Romney had presented himself as a third way running against the Bush and Obama legacies, that would have been an interesting positioning and an interesting message. And I don't think he did that. And there are various reasons why. I think that the fact that conservatives were always skeptical of Romney meant that he didn't have the leeway to sort of create this interesting narrative, which would have been, let's be honest, it would have been manufactured, but, you know, a lot of the compassionate conservatism came from somewhere, too. and so did hope and change. I mean, Romney could have invented a storyline about himself as being the answer, you know, the response to not just Obama, but to Bush and Obama. He couldn't do it for a variety of reasons. He wasn't trusted by conservatives enough to do that. I also think there's a fear of...
But doesn't the first debate performance undercut... I mean, I think you're right that Romney felt that way. But look, his best moment in the entire campaign was the first debate, and he was prosecuting a moderate message.
Well, I think he should have gone...
And as we talked about last week, conservatives said, we're okay with that so long as you're winning.
I think he should have gone further. I think so he should have gone...
Why couldn't he done that?
He should have gone further with that. And I don't think it's a moderate message in the sense that all of a sudden he's like, well, I'm pro-choice. And, you know, I think it's more of a tonal thing and more of a rhetorical thing. But look, I think you're right. I think he should have become... Romney should have essentially triangulated and become the mainstream center-right candidate, and allowed Obama to be over there on the far left. And I think part of that could have encompassed going after Bush. Now, he was critical of Bush. I don't think it was enough, But I still think it'll be interesting if there's any sort of retribution. I mean, the Bush clan is very protective. We saw just, you know, a month or so ago at the Republican convention, Jeb Bush took to the stage and told Barack Obama to, you know, basically quit picking on my brother. Will Jeb and Poppy Bush have anything to say about Mitt Romney? That will be interesting. Or will they suck it up and be good soldiers and take one for the team?
I agree. Now, we have any other moments of debate that you thought were particularly notable?
Let's see here. Let me think.
I think one of the big things was myself that you know, Romney still can't answer the question, how are you going to make your tax revenue neutral? He's promised to make it revenue neutral. He's saying, I'm not going to sock it to the middle class. But anyone who's asked point blank about it, he doesn't give you anything. You know, and Obama got kind of mocked for hitting Big Bird for so long over this two-week interval. But I think that Obama essentially spent his 2 weeks, you know, queuing up this case. You know, it's, I mean, as weak as the energy level was in the first debate, you know, he let Romney show his hand in the first debate. He could then take what he said and contrast it to the other part of the record, lay that predicate, you know, in stump speeches and ads for the 2 weeks, and then bring it to the debate. And Romney should have known that was coming.
Yeah, well, look,
why can't Romney just spit out two more specifics just to have a rebuttal?
I don't know if it's that Romney can't explain it or that he won't explain it. And I think it's the latter. And I think this speaks to something, Bill, that I've been saying probably for years now, which is that this is a very ugly campaign. Neither side has a visionary message or sort of a proactive message. Romney's message is Obama's horrible, the economy stinks. Obama's message is Romney's rich and he's like, you know, Bush and Bain Capital and all that stuff. Neither of them really want to get into vision or even plans. They don't want to talk about it. And so Romney now has a secret plan to balance the budget. I mean, he doesn't want to talk about it. So anyway, that's not really anything new. It's a continuation. I will say this. I think one of the things that was remarkable about the debate and is probably being overshadowed by Candy Crowley is how the debate became very uncomfortable and primal and nearly physical, very reminiscent of Al Gore sort of standing up and invading George W. Bush's physical space in 2000. I found it to be very uncomfortable and just to watch. I think that in America, we have fought wars of ideas in the political realm. I mean, sure, we've caned each other in Congress from time to time, but by and large, physical threats, even if it's intimated, don't happen. You can criticize people from the comfort of your blog or your TV studio or even a debate floor, and you don't have to worry that someone might take a swing at you. And I hope I'm not overplaying this, but I really don't want to see a country where this sort of machismo thing dominates. It bothers me. I did not like it when Al Gore did that, and I think probably in this instance Romney and Obama were both guilty. But what's your take?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think the issues are quite parallel. Gore did that in the third debate. He got dinged in the first debate for being condescending and sighing too much. He got dinged in the second debate for being too low energy and being completely soporific. And he was trying to find a sweet spot in the third debate and knock Bush off his game. And I think in that moment there, he probably came across it seemed too staged. He was going to walk across the room and stand somewhat physically close to Bush and try to rattle him. It just didn't seem like a natural act to do. And Bush, you know, essentially shrugged it and laughed it off, saying, "What's
Bush
this,
handled
you know,
it?
Look
Bush
at his,
handled
like,
it
what's
incredibly
this?
Well. There's no right. doubt about that."
Right. I don't think what happened last night was stagey like that. You had two guys having a scrap. And I suspect that on one hand, you know, your average swing voter is gonna growl and say, why is all this bickering? Why can't we have a real discussion? Of course, we had that real discussion at the first debate. Everybody complained about that it was too boring.
Well, the town hall debate sort of lends itself to this because they're not behind a podium. They're walking around. I mean, they've got those little bar stools or director's chairs or whatever. But look, I'm not concerned they'll – and I hope I'm not overplaying this, but I'm not concerned about the optics of this or how – if it might turn off women. I'm concerned about whether or not this becomes a trend in our politics, because both men seemed to be viscerally angry, and it seemed to be verging on sort of a primal physical thing. And I think that part of our sort of contract in this whole thing is that we fight with words and ideas. And once you start, even if they never touch each other, it's a sort of a physical intimidation. I think that leads us down a path that I'm not terribly comfortable with. And I don't think it's...
Well, actually, the course of these two debates so far, I mean, this is still a deeply substantive discussion that they're having. You know, this is not just repeated fires of character assassination. They're talking... I mean, this is a very issue-based debates that we're having. I think there's a level of drama, more so in the second one than the first. I think there is an acceptance on both sides that, you know, drama matters, that it does bring in... attention. There is a innate desire to people to want to see how two ideas, you know, sort of physically stack up against each other. What do you do when you're pressed? When your idea is challenged? If I'm an undecided voter, chances are I can't fully make heads or tails of your talking points. What happens when they collide? And you know, the first debate seemed that, you know, when they collided, Obama shriveled up, and therefore it must mean there's something weak about his case.
We know
the second time Romney seems more...
We know that the taller candidate, in this case it's Romney, but the taller candidate usually wins. What does this say for the little spindly 5'7", 150-pound guy out there? I mean, I guess he...
Michael Dukakis sympathizes with you.
He can't. He just can't even attempt this. I mean...
We can't shut off our brains. We can't shut off basic concepts of human nature and neurology. And good campaigns find out a way to deal with this fact. Now, if you deal with this fact through a completely superficial issues list way, that would be really disturbing. We're having a basic debate here about the role of government, which is not, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. If Romney, I mean, Obama did not bring those types of dramatic tools at his disposal in the first debate, actually deliberately. I think he was trying to make it as boring a debate as possible so it wouldn't politically matter because he was in the lead. And it didn't quite work out the way he intended. You know, Romney came with a high energy performance. He has to know that his energy level was relative to his success. So he can't complain now that he didn't play that game well enough, and that's unfair. You know, you have to play by the rules of the game, and part of the rules of the game is how the human brain works. The human brain works is not totally logical.
I don't want to be a dead horse. Let me just say, I'm all for vigorous, robust debate. People can yell, but it makes me uncomfortable to think. And look, there's this movie Idiocracy where, you know, the president is an ex-professional wrestler. And I don't want to, you know, it seemed to me watching the debate last night that we're maybe a decade away from that being, you know, being a necessity. It bothers me. I fear that there's a trend. I'd love to hear what our viewers and listeners think of this. Is this me being a little pansy?
You go back in history, we've had way more scurrilous presidential campaigns, way more nastier stuff. You know, whether it's recent American history or it's you know, 18th century, 19th century, in the wide scope of things, this is pretty
good.
Well,
you know what? This is, we're one step away now. It's not just the candidates; they start being now they bring their thugs. I mean, you know, what's next? Where does it end? I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't like.
Well, I mean, I do think we are at a point, go back into some of this debate history stuff. You know, one of the things that's been mentioned about the 84 debate is that, you know, at that point, there only was 76 and 80. You know, 1960 was way in the rearview mirror, nothing happened in between those points. And Reagan was up by double digits over Mondale, so he could very easily say, I'm not going to debate you, try to stop me. But Reagan actually proactively made a decision to have the debates anyway, and that's credited for embedding having these showdowns as part of the American civic life. And no campaign's been able to really dare to not have one ever since. And now we've been having the town hall format as one of the three. You know, we've had three almost every time. In 96 we had two, but 1992, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, they've all been sort of the same structure, three debates, one town hall, one foreign policy, and one VP. I think as a general matter, people feel like that's enough. You know, more than that, it gets too played, you know, one time, it doesn't get to all the issues. You know, give the moderator a chance to ask questions. Give the voters a chance to ask questions. You know, this seems like a good balance, I think, to most folks. They certainly get the numbers, ratings-wise, to justify doing it this way. I think you're probably going to see this structure remain for the foreseeable future. I think the complaints that you have brought up so far, I really doubt are going to rise to the level where it seems like the public is angry about this stuff. The public is angry about Candy Crowley, that she thought she way overstepped her bounds, and demands put upon the commission to radically change things because of these kinds of frustrations. That's my guess. Now, if you got to a point where let's say the polls break back to Obama's way, he wins very handily, conservatives say it was this unfair debate that was the moment, it's Crowley's fault, it was the bad selecting of the voters, and that leads to the next Republican candidate rejecting the format and refusing to debate. Something like that, I think, could make the commission rethink things because they want these debates to occur. So long as if that Republican plays that card and doesn't suffer political consequences for it, that puts the onus on the commission to change things. I think you have to reach that point because, I mean, the commission is run by a Republican and a Democrat. They are trying to keep things copacetic. And if that breaks down, that's what forces their hand. But I would be immensely surprised if what happened last night reaches that level and forces their hand.
Probably a good place to end it. Great conversation, and I encourage our viewers and listeners to chime in, because what do you think about this? Especially, what do you think? I'd love to know what you think about the am I overreacting to the physical thing? Is this, you know, am I some effete East Coast conservative? But Bill, great show as always, my friend.
And if people can respond, you know, both in the comment threads here at BloggingEds, but also we're on the Twitters. You know, Matt's at Matt K. Lewis, I'm at Bill Scher. We also have the DMZ Show Twitter feed, and there's also the BloggingEds Twitter feed. And there is a little, you know, widget, BloggingEds widget, where our tweets show up on BloggingEds.tv.
And so you may not know this. Not only you can watch us here, but you can also listen on iTunes. You can download, search for DMZ Show or BloggingEds. And you can listen, you know, you're on the metro, you're on the treadmill, you're out for a walk with your pug, whatever it is, you can listen to the audio of this, and you will miss our handsome faces, but still a good listen. So.
And your podcast, there's the Matt Lewis Show podcast, there's Liberal Oasis Show podcast, which is now also on the YouTubes at youtube.com/liberaloasis.tv. I encourage you to subscribe there. Where can they find your podcast, Matt?
You get it on iTunes or at mattklewis.com.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Till next week,
good
sir.
Show.
Take care.